Hello, and welcome back to Sperio on WMBR Cambridge. We're here today with Scott and Catelyn, and our hosts, Froy, Jasmine, Mary, me, and Kat. So Kat's new, so we want to welcome her. Kat, do you want to come say hello?
She just joined us like 2 minutes ago. So, hi Kat!
Hi.
Okay. Thank you. Yeah, good to have you here. So before we start talking to Scott and Kat, we're going to listen to Froy's news. So.
All right. So let's start with some news from south from the border. Mexico has announced it will send a total of 7,000 soldiers and federal police officers into the border city of Ciudad Juarez, where at least 1,600 people died last year in drug-related violence. Ciudad Juarez is located across the U.S. border from El Paso, Texas. The city's police chief resigned almost 2 weeks ago after several of his officers were shot to death and anonymous signs appeared warning that an officer will be killed every 48 hours unless he stepped down. On Sunday, an interview on Meet the Press, Defense Secretary Robert Gates said that the U.S. military will increase its support of Mexico. En español, México anunció que enviará un total de 7,000 soldados y oficiales de la Policía Federal a la fronteriza ciudad de Ciudad Juárez, donde 1,600 personas han muerto el año pasado en incidentes violentos relacionados con las drogas. La Ciudad Juárez está ubicada al otro lado del Paso, Texas, en la frontera con Estados Unidos. El jefe de la policía de la ciudad renunció hace casi 2 semanas luego de que varios de sus oficiales fueran asesinados a balazos y aparecieran mensajes anónimos advirtiendo que moriría un oficial cada 48 horas, a menos de que él renunciara. El domingo, durante una entrevista en el programa Meet the Press, el secretario de Defensa Robert Gates dijo que las Fuerzas Armadas estadounidenses aumentarían el apoyo a México. In Florida, 2 students from Chile were killed last week when a gunman opened fire on a townhouse where they were staying. Police are investigating the shooting as a likely hate crime. 3 other Chilean students were injured in the shooting. A 60-year-old man named Danny Baker has been charged with the killings. Baker was known for his anti-immigrant views. The Southern Poverty Law Center recently reported that hate crimes against Latinos jumped by 40% between 2003 and 2007. En Florida, 2 estudiantes de Chile fueron asesinados la semana pasada cuando un hombre armado abrió fuego contra la residencia donde estaban hospedados. La policía está investigando el incidente como un posible crimen de odio. Otros 3 estudiantes chilenos resultaron heridos en el tiroteo. Un hombre de 60 años llamado Danny Baker fue acusado de los asesinatos. Baker era conocido por sus opiniones en contra de los inmigrantes. La organización jurídica Southern Poverty Law Center recientemente informó que los crímenes de odio contra los latinos habían aumentado un 40% entre el 2003 y el 2007. In U.S. news, the Obama administration has reversed a Bush administration rule gutting the Endangered Species Act. A new presidential memorandum restores a long-standing provision that requires an independent scientific review of any federal project that could affect a protected species. The rule change is expected to delay at least 2 pending projects, one, a Bureau of Land Management plan for overseeing Oregon's forests, and the White Pine Coal Fire Power Plant in Nevada. El gobierno de Obama revocó un mandato del gobierno de Bush que había eliminado partes de la ley de especies en peligro de extinción. Un nuevo memorando presidencial restableció una disposición que estuvo vigente durante mucho tiempo, que exige un análisis científico independiente de cualquier proyecto federal que pueda afectar a las especies protegidas. Se prevé que este cambio normativo retrasara al menos 2 proyectos pendientes, un plan de la Oficina de Administración de Tierras para supervisar los bosques de Oregón y la planta de energía alimentada con carbón White Pine en Nevada. And one more news from the U.S., President Obama has also voiced support for a measure that would ease barriers for workers to join unions. On Tuesday, Obama gave a videotaped address to a gathering of AFL-CIO leaders in Miami. Obama vowed passage of the Employee Free Choice Act, which will stop employers from demanding secret ballot elections and require them to recognize unions if a majority of workers consented. The Senate is expected to take up the measure in the coming weeks. El presidente Obama expresó su apoyo a una medida que eliminaría los obstáculos para que los trabajadores se unan a los sindicatos. El martes, Obama dio un discurso por videoconferencia en una reunión de los líderes de la Federación Sindical AFL-CIO en Miami. Obama prometió aprobar la ley de libre elección de los empleados, que impediría que los empleadores exijan elecciones con voto secreto, y los obligarían a reconocer a los sindicatos si la mayoría de los trabajadores lo aprueban. Se prevé que el Senado analizará esta medida en las próximas semanas. And finally, one last piece of news. Obama is also facing opposition from members of his own party on a plan to reduce tax deductions for wealthy Americans. The plan will save around $318 billion over 10 years. Under questioning from Senate Finance Committee Chair Max Baucus, Wednesday Treasury Secretary Timothy Geithner said the Obama administration will consider dropping the proposal. Mientras tanto, Obama enfrenta la oposición de miembros de su propio partido en lo que respecta a un plan para reducir las deducciones impuestas a los estadounidenses adinerados. El plan permitiría ahorrar alrededor de $318 mil millones en un periodo de 10 años. Interrogado por el presidente del Comité de Finanzas del Senado, Max Baucus, el secretario del Tesoro, Timothy Geithner, dijo que la administración Obama consideraría la posibilidad de retirar esta propuesta. Those are some of the news of this week.
Hello, and thanks for the news, Froy. You're listening to WMBR Cambridge, to the program Sperio, and we're here today with Scott and Catlin. So I was wondering if you guys could just introduce yourselves and say what you do at MIT and what your projects are.
Sure. Well, Catlin, would you like to go first?
It's all you, Scott.
Okay. Maybe I'll start with the last first. I'm currently a senior at MIT studying electrical engineering and computer science. And I guess I started working in the Himalayan region about 4 years ago. And so that's where at least my portion of this, what we'll be talking about today, has stemmed from.
I'm actually a Wellesley College student. I'm studying chemistry and environmental studies there, and I started working in the Himalayan region about 3 years ago. So that's my background.
Awesome. So can you guys tell us what I know you have a nonprofit you've started and all this other stuff. So can you, I guess, give us a summary of what you've done over the past few years? I don't know how long you've both been involved, like how long you've been involved, but a summary of like what you've done, what you've accomplished, and just to acquaint people with what it is exactly, I guess.
Sure. Well, let's see. We've been focusing on a few different areas of problems in the Himalayas. We're looking at rural energy generation, water and sanitation, and also education and infrastructure.
As well as indoor air quality.
Right. And so there are so many ways in which all of these things are very interrelated that it's really a very holistic and systematic approach that needs to be taken in order to address just one of them. And there are a lot of different types of poverty, too, that we're addressing. There's fuel poverty, education poverty, so there are many different factors involved in this.
And we're trying to inspire rural people to be able to use science and engineering tools to solve problems in their lives by themselves without help from outside sources. So hopefully our work will actually make people independent in that way.
Right. I guess the goal in a few years would be to be out of a job, if you will, for people to start creating their own solutions and addressing their own problems themselves. That's the ultimate goal. And I think that's maybe one of the ways that these types of projects and future work could continue and also be very successful.
Could you describe in detail the work that you guys did? Like, I understand that it's development work, but and you also mentioned like water quality and things like that.
And it's also 4 years in the work, which cannot be probably summed up in 50 minutes. But you know, maybe what start with the last.
Yeah.
Summer. I don't know.
So actually, we've only been functioning as an NGO for about 1 year. And in that time, we've done water quality education, so teaching people how to analyze their own water sources for things like arsenic and bacteria. We've done several different types of energy solutions. So the Soul Source Project would be one of them, which is a 3-in-1 solar cooker, solar heater, and solar thermoelectricity generator. We've also done some air quality assessments for people, because actually women are just traditionally, when a woman got sick with some sort of lung disease, mm-hmm. then it was thought in the villages that she had been a bad woman because she had angered the spirit of the hearth, which is the center of the household. And women are just starting to rebel against that and ask for the data to show that this is not actually the case, that there's another reason. And so we're working with a lot of women's groups in the area to try to prove that to the other villagers.
Right. So you could look at this as leveraging science and engineering to provide also more quantitative and comparable methods of looking at what the situation is and perhaps taking a slightly different perspective on the current condition.
When you mean air quality tests, do you mean indoor air quality tests,
correct.
Right?
Right. Yeah.
Indoor exposure assessments.
Not city outside.
Right. Yeah. Okay. Most of the areas that we're looking at are very rural. In other words, you have to either walk to them because they're over a mountain pass or they're maybe half a day by bus away from the nearest city. And so it's quite remote. And also because of the environment, it's a very extreme, harsh area where people over many, many generations have really been their own engineers. And they've found ways to develop ways of living in such a harsh environment.
But what's interesting now is that because of the encroachment of Western civilization, really, is what it comes down to. People are starting to lose confidence in their traditional culture of engineering and innovation. So we're trying to work with people to say, hey, it's, you know, actually not so different. Your own ideas of how to do sustainable development, for example, are actually much better in many ways than what's coming in from outside. Even though the foreign solutions may look more glamorous, it's only because they're advertised with only the good points, whereas you in your communities know both the bad and the good sides of your own solutions. So of course they appear more glamorous, but there are bad sides to foreign solutions as well.
Right, and when these technologies are newly introduced ways of living or functioning in life come in, people don't feel a lot of ownership over them because they don't understand how they're made, or maybe they don't understand exactly why they're using this one in other parts of the world versus perhaps the ones that they grew up using. And so that kind of alienation, I think, creates a divide where people then, maybe they, as Catelyn was just mentioning, they see the advertisements and they see all the great things about, say, a TV. And so they think that really the city holds all of the value, or that that's where the next thing is going on. And so a lot of the younger generations are very interested in going to cities and forgetting some of their past.
Or another interesting example is that cars are really being advertised in a lot of places now. So nomads, for example, have gone out and traded their horses and gotten cars instead. But then the trucks can't get up to the same altitude grazing grounds that they normally go to. So then they have a big problem.
Right. So in a lot of ways, the foreign technologies aren't exactly suited or customized for the local needs.
So I know a lot of students at MIT and at other colleges are always wondering how they can start getting involved in projects like this, because what you've done is really amazing, right? So I wonder if you could tell us how you first got started and what resources enabled you to pursue the project and the nonprofit.
I think the biggest one is really the connections with the community. Both Scott and I have been inspired by those, and it's really the support of the community and the connection, the trade-off between how we can contribute to a solution that has made all of this go forward.
Right. It's really that dependency that I think allows everything to progress, because we're certainly not the experts about these local areas. I mean, we've tried to spend time there to understand, but never will we be able to understand it as well as those people who are coming from these communities.
Why there? How did you guys come to pick that region?
Just by chance, I think, for both of us.
Yeah, I had interest when I first visited, and traveling through there, I had a chance to very early on get to know some of the communities, and hearing a lot of the complaints, especially from women, they would spend maybe 5 to 6 hours per day collecting fuel. And it's just very laborious, and it's something that, you know, as a result, they don't have opportunities for pursuing education or for income generation. And these things add up to create a gender inequality among many other difficulties in the community. And so it was these personal connections and really learning what the people's stories were that drew me in. And I just found myself going back.
How do you communicate with them? Just wondering.
So Scott is very good at Mandarin, I would say. At least he's quite good at communicating with people. And I have studied some Tibetan and some Mandarin as well. So we're able to get by a little bit in that way. But we also have a lot of local community partners who speak English as well.
That's true. And that's maybe one of our, deficits is that if we were able to speak fluently with people in their native language, I think that that would definitely be a boost to what we're doing. And sometimes, like maybe it's Ladakhi or Nepali or Bhutanese, and these kinds of languages, they're similar in a lot of ways. And so maybe we can get the idea of what might be going on. But it's I think also a really great opportunity that we can include the local people who can not only act as translators, but really they're contributing a lot to the projects and the ideas.
Yeah.
Seems to be a very outstanding experience you had there. I'm curious about how it has affected you in a personal level.
So my background has been a little bit strange. I spent much of my, what would normally have been high school years, traveling to different areas of the world and becoming involved in these types of projects. And when I came to college, I went to Wellesley to study international relations, actually, to try to figure out how I could contribute to solutions in that way, in the development context. And I fell in love with chemistry while I was there, and I got really far away from it. And so this really has been an opportunity for me to come back to what is, become more grounded and really realize this is the reason for doing everything that I've been doing. So in that way, it's been very good for me.
And you've had a lot of chances to, sorry to interject here, to apply your other passions and interests, right? Like applying chemistry, for example.
Yeah, it's really allowed me to see how it all fits together.
Well, Mike was far away. So that's really interesting. But is that something that you see yourself doing in the future as well? Like, this is your passion, right? And I mean, it's amazing what you guys are doing. But how practical is it to continue this work? Is it sustainable?
Well, our goal is for it to be sustained by the communities themselves. We would certainly love to continue working with them, but it's really supposed to be community sustained.
Right.
Does that make sense?
So in a way, it's kind of maybe like ambivalence that you wanted to succeed because you want to see these people in a better position. But in a way, if they're completely 100% successful, your connection to them might not be, you know, what
necessary.
It was.
Right.
You know, necessary. And maybe personal ties, you know, I don't know, you will not be there for work.
Yeah, exactly. They evolve, and maybe you're going back for someone's wedding instead of
cool.
going back to and actually
we've had that experience.
That just happened this past month. We had gone to visit an old friend's wedding. But right. You're right. Maybe it's looking at it as though we're hoping that engineering can be democratized. In other words, people there can be creating things and solving problems, and maybe right now we're going there and traveling there ourselves, and we're having a lot of exchanges with the community. But I think that in the future, this relationship will become more of an exchange where we may be giving some, but they're also giving back to us. And I mean, personally, I think we've been receiving a lot and getting a lot out of it, but I think there's a lot that we can learn from each other.
Yeah.
I just want to remind listeners that you're listening to WMVR Cambridge, Sperio. So I think it's really interesting what you've been saying, Scott. And also, I think it's interesting how many parallels there are between the communities you describe in Tibet and the ones I've been to in Peru. For instance, what you said about the women kind of end up gathering firewood and doing a lot of the chores, and there's kind of an imbalance in that respect. And so, like, I think there needs to be a lot done in terms of raising awareness of women's rights and that sort of thing. I wanted to ask, in kind of along the lines of sustainability, but on a broader scale, do you think that the work you've been doing could be applied to a lot of other communities, like the ones in Peru? And how do you think it's scalable, I guess, to achieve change on a much broader scale? Because it sounds like it's successful enough that you can start maybe going to other communities and doing similar things. Or
we certainly hope that that's the case. And as we're going through all of our work with these communities, we're trying to document and come up with what are the parameters that could be used for people to implement them in other communities. For example, when we're doing water quality testing or indoor air quality testing, or when we're trying to develop different energy solutions, what are the parallels, and can we document that in a way that other NGOs or other communities can use that information?
Right, and a lot of these projects would start based off of a community need that they express to us. And so, as you mentioned, with the Peruvian area maybe being so very high in altitude and there being a lot of similar conditions, then maybe there is opportunity to start applying some of those solutions developed for one area and changing them to locally fit the context of another.
Correct. And we also are running several databases on, again, air quality and water quality, and are hoping that the compilation of that information is going to be along the same lines.
So we're gonna have some music now, I think. What's it called?
Yeah, it's called the Ragtime Dance. It's one of the Tibetan music, and Scott is going to introduce for us. It's he brought in a lot of different music for us today. So
sure, yeah. If it's the song I'm thinking of, then this is one of several songs that are my personal favorite, and I think it's hard. I don't know where the listeners are right now, but if you're in your car or if you're at home, I think it's difficult to picture exactly what's going on in the song. But if you can imagine, it's a large fire with people dancing in a circle around it in very rhythmic music motions to the music. And this is something that is usually taking place either in the summer or the winter time, and it's very closely associated with a lot of other festivals and family time and merriment.
It's a traditional Tibetan circle dance.
Due to some technical... It's not funny. Hi, welcome back to Spirio. We're just having some issues with the music, so I don't think we're going to play the song yet. Mary is trying to figure out what she could do with the song. So I guess I'll just go back to asking you guys questions. It'll be, I'm wondering, when you just like first go there and try to implement all these different, you know, cool programs, how do people react to it? And could you describe like the first day or like the everyday activity that you do by, you know, you get up at, I don't know, 6 a.m. and then like how the day goes?
So usually we're working with the communities from quite a bit before we start implementing a program. So they really have a say, and actually they're really the people shaping how the programs will happen. And so there's, I'm not sure I would say that there's a particular routine to every day, but I would say that the... Scott, you want to help me out here? Did you just...
So the typical day when you go there, how the day runs?
Or maybe even just before that, you know, how did the connection
started? You know, how did you even start it to... How did you choose a community, specific community? Because, you know, there's like I don't know how many community, but more than 1,000. And how do you choose with the 1 or 2 or 3 or 4, I don't know, that you were working with, dealing with?
Right. Usually we try to choose communities that have people in them who have the background and who are willing to help us propagate that information. So communities in which will... Scott, can you help me describe?
Yeah. So most of the partners we begin working with, maybe they've carried on their own small-scale development projects already, and they have interest in continuing these, but they recognize in many cases, as is expressed to us, that with some additional support, either maybe it's understanding how to do a certain type of test so they can, you know, quantify some type of problem and then communicate that to donors. You know, that's a very common way that I think our relationships start. So one concrete example of that is with indoor air pollution. It's something that you can see and around you, and you can see a lot of the effects, but actually putting that into numbers and being able to justify what you're explaining to a donor is something that's very important in order to get funding for your project. And so some of our relationships are like that, where we're helping to provide some of the scientific support, and then they, of course, are the local experts, and they're our eyes on the ground.
So what Scott's saying is that as much as possible, we try to support projects that are currently happening, so that, or about to happen, projects where there's someone who really has the passion to see it through there on the ground in the community. And what that means is not only that the project will go through in the community, but also that it will be spread to other communities in many cases. So our criteria for trying to choose communities to run projects in is not necessarily the community that's the poorest or something like this, because it's impossible to find that information, but try to find a community that will lead to a sustainable outcome.
Oh, sorry, Froy. I think we're gonna try the song again. So hopefully this time it'll work. Otherwise, we'll be back in like 2 seconds.
This is Melora from Rasputina, and you're listening to WMBR Cambridge and Ghost Rider of Sleepy Holler.
Keep open the shop, where you're not selling fish hooks anymore. You are the free swimming fish.
Bwanji.
Namaste.
Tune into music for human beings.
New Age Talk Radio with an emphasis on you.
Think that you're gliding out from the face of a cliff like an eagle. Think you're walking like a tiger walks by himself in the forest. You're most handsome when you're after food. Spend less time with nightingales and peacocks. One's just a voice, the other's just a color.
Friday, 7 p.m., WMBR in Cambridge, 88.1 FM.
Hi, welcome back to Spherio. We are here on WMBR in Cambridge, MIT. And today we are having a conversation with Scott and Kat about their project in Himalaya. And it's really interesting. To carry on the conversation that we've been having so far, I'd like to ask you guys, what are the current projects that you guys have been working on? And where do you see the direction that it's going?
Sure. Well, one of the newest ones, I'll speak about that first, and I think Catelyn will tell you about the energy-related project. So this latest one is looking at distributing very simple and easy-to-understand ways of testing water quality, and doing this in a way that's not only providing more awareness to local people about what local water quality is like, but also helping to provide some understanding and, you know, introduction to some science concepts in a way that makes sense locally. And taking this information, we'll then be aggregating it online, so putting it on so that it'll be visualized by anyone who's going to a website. And so this would be useful not only for spreading worldwide awareness about what is water quality like, but also for scientists or academics who are interested in particular areas, and especially for connecting these communities who are in need of water solutions with those people who have them. There's so many experts in the field who know exactly what to do for certain water problems. They just don't know where in the world people are having those problems. And so by connecting these two groups and also providing information on the website for local communities who want to know more about this water problem, that they maybe see a rash on their skin or maybe they're getting headaches from the water, and providing them with information about some of the reasons why that might be happening and what they can do.
We're also doing a similar project for air quality and aggregating the data into a database as well, and working on the implementation of some of our energy technologies. So the big one that's coming up is trying to work with nomadic communities to help them generate income off of the solar cooker that we've been developing, which is made out of traditional nomadic tent material.
Can you say a little bit more about the solar cooker and like how much it costs? I know this.
Sure. <It's really> cheap. So the original price estimate that this solar cooker was slated to be was about $17.
Well, can you explain first what is the solar cooker? Because maybe not everyone knows.
Right, that's a really good question. So it's actually a solar concentrator. So it's in the shape of a satellite dish, and it focuses sunlight in a single point. And so with that concentrated energy, you can then use the sunlight for either cooking food or for, say, heating a house, which that's really a big distribution of the energy that people consume on a daily basis, as well as
about
you can use
75%.
Right, 75%. And you can also use that concentrated solar for producing electricity. And so it's like a platform that you can have many interchangeable parts depending on what your needs are.
And we've tried to develop a portable one, which is something that people can take out to the field with them, or it's easy to migrate from place to place with.
How long are these, how long do these generally last in the field, do you think?
And how much does it cost?
Yeah.
Yeah, those are really good questions. So, although we can give estimates about how long we think it will last based off of the materials we're using and prior experience, I think the real tale will be told when we put it in people's hands and when they're able to field test it and not only tell us what they think of it and whether it was meeting some of the original complaints they had and the needs that they wanted addressed, but it'll also be under the gauntlet. They'll be the ones using it and we'll see how long it lasts.
To clarify, we've done some short-term field tests already, but we really need a six-month to a year-long field test to get some real data.
Right.
So,
And then for cost, so our previous estimate was $17, and based off of some of the changes and improvements in the materials we're using, it should be lower than that.
That's very exciting. Is it really successful at heating water? Like, does it and cooking food and stuff, or is it? I guess does it take a reasonable amount of time for this stuff to heat up and for people to use it? And have people seem to be very accepting of it?
Right. Yeah. Good question. So we were just there in the winter, but during the summertime, other solar cookers might take about 10 minutes to say boil 2 liters of water. And during the winter, as we were testing ours against the existing options that just do cooking, whereas, as we mentioned, 75% of fuel use is actually in the heating of the home. So ours tries to address a few different areas. But just comparing the water boiling time, ours was comparable to the current one. And there are actually many improvements that we're making on it, so we think that it will definitely be a viable option.
And I'm actually going to be part of the team that's working on the heating the homes element of this in the future, so I'm really excited about that.
As are we.
Yeah, we're all going to be working together. So, Kat, did you have any questions or no?
Maybe going off of that same comment you made, we're actually really interested in involving more people with what we're doing, not only people here in, say, the Boston area community, but people all over the world. And that's particularly one interest we have, is looking at these many different areas with similar ideas and approaches to problems. And so we hope that our next step after the Himalayan region can be, say, in Patagonia, in Peru, and in these areas. And so we're coming in with open arms, and we hope to get to know more people in these areas and familiar with these types of problems.
Well, of course. I'm also an environmental engineer, so I'm also very excited about your project and just all the information from kind of underdeveloped area in Vietnam, and I can relate to what you have been saying and your passion about it, and yeah, I'm really looking forward to see your next project.
Well, thanks. We definitely can't do it alone. We depend a lot on the local areas. I mean, the people from those areas are really, really passionate about what they do, and we depend a lot on their support and their input, and they're, I think, really the ones who make the projects and our work what it is.
Yeah.
And I know recently that you did very well in the 100K competition, so I wondered if you could, tell people about that and what it is. And
oh, yeah.
Advertise yourselves how cool you are.
Just last night we found out that we are semi-finalists in the MIT 100K development track, and that's a more entrepreneurial competition. And what we're looking to do with that is referring back to something that Catelyn had mentioned before when she was talking about having nomadic people to produce this solar concentrator for themselves. And so we're pursuing that, and we've actually also submitted several different grants and applications to many other organizations.
Yeah. We've passed on to the second round of the St. Andrews Prize judging. St. Andrews Prize for the Environment, as well as
Echoing Green
and Davis Peace Projects, 100 Projects for Peace.
Right. And then there was also a recent submission for an EPA grant.
Oh, yeah, the EPA P3 as well. Haven't heard back yet, though.
Do you have grant writers in your team? Oh, two of you guys. Wow. Wait, how big is your team?
There are maybe about 12 people on the U.S. side, I would say, and it consists of students and professionals and also professors from several different schools.
Yeah, MIT, Harvard, Wellesley, Berkeley, those are the core people. And then we also have quite a large team on the ground in Qinghai and several people that we're working with in Ladakh as well.
And yeah, Ladakh is in North India, and then we have an additional partner group, which consists of NGOs and others who are in Nepal, Bhutan, and also in Western China. So we really rely a lot on our network.
Yeah.
Wow, that's amazing. I think some people here, including myself, kind of want to try something new and get involved in the development work, but it's very hard to get connected to it, or it's just hard to figure out where to start, right? And I think it's interesting how you guys, I don't know, had the idea and went into it, and things are just going better and better, so that's really awesome. Is there like a website that people could visit for more information?
You know, that's a really good question. There is a website, which for some reason it seems like it might be down. I just noticed this about two hours ago.
It's usually not, though. It's just today. Server's down.
But I think this is a really good chance to realize that technology isn't always the answer, and that relying maybe on the skills you have and the previous knowledge you have is really important. And I guess in that case, I have to admit that I do have a background in computer science. So we'll see if what I just said comes true. But the website is oneearthdesigns.org, and so there are no spaces, no dashes in between that.
One with number or
it's out? Written out. So oneearthdesigns.org. And that website, I think it's currently down, but it'll probably be up very soon. And otherwise, maybe contacting us by email might be another way. My email is quite short, so maybe I'll give that out. It's scott@mit.edu. Now, this has a particular spelling. My name just has one T, so it's scott@mit.edu.
You can also contact us through the website as well.
Great. What's your fondest memory when you were there? I bet there's a lot.
There are a lot. Oh,
too many to choose.
Choose one. Yeah, just one.
That might have been the hardest question of the night. I don't know.
Oh, but no one's talking.
I know.
Too difficult of a decision.
Not fun memories. I see.
I think maybe one of my fondest memories was, and it's happening every time, and it's, I guess, getting better and better, but each time I've returned, many of the friends that I met 4 years ago, I see them now, instead of in school, now they have their own NGOs, and they're carrying on their own projects. And so, you know, while I used to be able to know where they might live and be able to find them, now I find that they're often very far remote places, but they're doing, you know, very great, amazing work. And so it's a memory that's always changing, and I'm always surprised when I go back to see that there were students who had interest in development work, like I think many people here in our communities, and now they've had a chance to really take action, and they're solving problems from their own communities.
Yeah, that's a great point, actually. Some of our fondest memories are when the people that we're working with to do water quality testing or air quality testing actually understand better about the tests than we do and bring up points that we may have left out or forgotten about. So that's always very good memory to have.
Yeah.
Great. Thanks for joining with us today. Do you guys have any last comments?
Just that we really look forward to hearing from anyone else who's interested in these types of ideas or these issues, and we look forward to connecting with more.
Great. Yeah. Thank you so much for being here with us today.
Oh, thanks for having us.
Yes, thank you.
And now we have some announcements for you. Now we have some announcements. in Spanish and in English. This Sunday, March 8th at 4 p.m., there will be a film showing in celebration of International Women's Day. It will be at the Community Church of Boston, 565 Boylston Street, on the third floor. It will feature two short films depicting what women in the fight against apartheid in South Africa and in Palestine.
Este domingo, marzo 8, a las 4 de la tarde, habrá una película, diferentes películas en celebración del Día Internacional de la Mujer.
Esto será a cabo en el Teatro Comunitario, en la Comunidad Comunitaria Community Church de Boston, en el 565 de la calle Boylston, en el tercer piso. Mostrará dos películas acerca de gente peleando en contra de la separación en Sudáfrica y en Palestina.
This Monday, March 9th, from 7 to 9 p.m. in room number 32155 at MIT, the Ideas Competition and the Microloan Foundation will be hosting a microfinance symposium. If you're interested in attending, you can RSVP to ideasrsvp at mit.edu. You can join Harvard professor and microfinance expert Michael Chu and Triffin Evans, director of the Omidyar Tufts Microfinance Fund, for an engaging discussion around the state of microfinance and its contribution to development.
Este lunes, el marzo 9, de las 7 a las 9 de la noche, en el cuarto aquí en el MIT, en el cuarto 32155, en el edificio 32, la competencia de Ideas y la fundación de Microloans estará teniendo un simposio en microfinanzas. Si quieres atender, por favor mándenos un correo a ideas-rsvp@mit.edu. Si nomás un correo, podrás tú estar con el profesor de Harvard y con el experto en microfinanzas Michael Chu y Triffin Evans, director del Fondo de Microfinanzas Omidyar en Tufts, para tener una discusión bastante buena acerca de lo que es la microfinanzas y la contribución que tienen esto acerca del desarrollo.
Okay, so that's it for today. We'll return to you next week. We'll be talking to someone from Boston Ray Crisis Center, and we'll have more interesting discussions and news ready for you guys. So see you next week.
Luego.
Bye.
Is everything enough?
Oh, I guess the music isn't working again, which is fine. In that case, let's listen to the promo for Human Beings, who are coming up next. Okay, see you guys next time.
Shop where you're not selling fish hooks anymore. You are